A downtown brawl put Cincinnati in the national spotlight for all the wrong reasons. This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Today on our weekly news review, we'll talk about the fallout from the fight and how city leaders are responding. We'll also discuss whether Kentucky's political event of the summer, the Fancy Farm Picnic, is still relevant and who might get roasted there this weekend. And we'll ask whether Hamilton County has a stadium lease deal with the Bengals. Joining me now to get our news review started are Cincinnati Inquirer investigative reporter Dan Horn and breaking news reporter Cameron Knight and WVXU local government reporter Becca Costello. Welcome back, everybody.
Hi, Lucy.
Thank you.
So, Cameron, what do we know about this fight that happened downtown in the early morning hours of last Saturday?
So there was a series of viral videos that were posted. Some of them were picked up by conservative social media accounts, and they kind of caught fire and spread everywhere. And it has prompted local leaders, Elon Musk, politicians, everyone's sort of having to weigh in on the situation. But what we do know is that there was a single 911 call, according to Cincinnati police, that was made in response to this disturbance that was on 4th and Elm. It was around, I believe, 3 in the morning on July 26th, which was a Saturday. It was sort of after the Cincinnati Music Fest was sort of letting out. And there were several people who were described as victims. There were like three people in different incident reports that were described as victims. And police have said there have been five people identified as suspects. Three of those have been arrested. So that's sort of where we're standing right now with the basics.
Cameron, do we know what started this fight?
We do not. There has been some implications and some suggestions and some speculation, but as of right now, it's there's been no official word from police or otherwise about kind of what prompted this. And just to describe the situation, the videos show people kind of punching each other, knocking each other on the ground, hitting on each other as they're on the ground. And at one point, toward the end of the video, a female appears to be like practically knocked unconscious, if not knocked unconscious.
Yeah, this woman who was punched, it looks like she's punched by a man and she falls to the ground. Do we know anything more about her case?
I believe she is one of the victims that's cited amongst the complaints against the folks that have been arrested. But it is not, we've not been able to speak to these folks on the record about kind of what happened or anything. Mm-hmm. There was a 911 call released kind of over the weekend into today. And there was a single person who called 911 and sort of said there's multiple fights and people are acting crazy. And he wasn't sure if anyone had been injured. And that person, as part of the public record, a lot of times you're told to read off your phone number to the 911 dispatcher. And I reached out to that person this morning, but haven't heard back yet. So it's been hard to get a really clear idea of what's going on. But I'm sure more information appears to be coming out every hour right now. It's been a really active story.
Yeah. Dan, there seem to be multiple people recording cell phone videos of what happened. Tell us more about how this video started to get circulated.
Yeah, probably pretty predictably, given where we are today, the internet got to work doing what the internet does and spreading this all over the place. And the folks who were sharing these videos worked pretty hard, pretty quickly to fit this story into their own preferred, political narratives, as we've seen kind of on both sides of the spectrum here over the last several days. And so it's not shocking, but it happened pretty quickly. We went from a few posts locally. Signal 99 is a local Facebook page that emphasizes, focuses on law enforcement in Cincinnati. They were among the first to put this up. Within hours of that, it started making the rounds to other Facebook and Twitter feeds, X feeds. And so by the next day, you had some pretty major, primarily conservative feeds such as End Wokeness, Charlie Kirk's site, Elon Musk began sharing this and drawing conclusions that, as Cam said, we don't know a lot about this yet, other than what we could actually see in the video, the violence that we could see in the videos. But that didn't stop a lot of folks from drawing some conclusions pretty quickly from what they were seeing.
And without getting into the kind of gory details, what generally, what were the kind of conclusions people were drawing about this?
Well, some folks pretty quickly concluded this was racially motivated. There were a number of posts that said things like a black mob, a black teen mob, attacking a white couple at a music festival, that kind of thing. And, you know, the violence is terrible, and nothing we wrote or are saying here today minimizes that violence. But a lot of the facts remain to be known. No one knows what started this. It is pretty clear from the videos, though, this wasn't a random attack, that just someone was jumped. It started with an argument and a fight that evolved into this rolling brawl, and where the guy was getting kicked and punched on the ground. It did not actually happen at the music festival. It does not appear that the folks who were most seriously injured were actually together or a couple. There's just a lot of questions. As Cam said, we just don't know a lot about this, and a lot of folks from far and wide drew some conclusions pretty quickly about what was happening based on just what they were seeing in a video.
Cameron, Cincinnati City Council member Victoria Parks posted on Facebook not long after the videos surfaced, and she's gotten a lot of reaction to that, to her comments. Can you tell us a little bit about what she said and you know, if she's said much more about that post since then?
Sure. My colleague Scott Wortman has been reporting on this, and the Facebook post essentially was a comment or a post that said essentially they deserved a beat down, like the people who were attacked deserved it. And that pretty quickly got people fired up. I think we have a letter or an opinion piece, a letter to the editor today calling for her to resign. So it's, you know, been a hot button issue for sure. When we asked her about it, she said that in this country we have freedom of speech. However, you may not run into a crowded theater and scream fire. So through that, she kind of compared that analogy to, you know, there's protected speech and there's not protected speech. She would not say what was said in the brawl, like what her screaming fire analogy compares to, if there was something said in the video. She didn't explain how she knows it or what instigated the fight or what information she might have beyond what's been out there already. So she also said that she was grateful for the whole story. So somehow she, you know, people can draw their own conclusion that she has some more information that she's just not putting out there yet. But yeah, that's sort of where we're at. And there's obviously been some backlash about condoning violence and some pushback on her supporting this kind of thing. And some other people in city council have also made their own statements saying that they never want to incite or inflame violence. And they also, but there have been some comments too mentioning that this is being a very politicized situation, and people are kind of tacking their own narratives onto it, like Dan said.
Yeah. Well, yeah, we did get statements in our newsroom yesterday from Councilmember Mika Owens and also Councilmember Seth Walsh. Mika Owens' statement says in part, "Councilmember Parks has been a civil servant in Cincinnati for decades, and her service is deeply appreciated. However, However, making comments that inflame a violent incident is never acceptable. As I've said in previous statements to the media, one of the most critical responsibilities of elected officials is to communicate effectively, and I believe that endorsing violence is neither effective nor responsible. That's part of her statement. Here's a portion of Councilmember Walsh's statement. It says, "Violence is violence. There is no justification for it ever. The violence we witnessed this weekend is unacceptable in our city, and all of us must work to ensure it is never acceptable in Cincinnati." Councilmember Parks' statement defending the actions of those involved in this weekend's incident is deeply irresponsible and undermines the principles of public safety and community trust. And that's part of his statement. Dan, talk a little bit more about how this has become political. You mentioned that this was shared by, some conservative social media pages and accounts. Talk about who else is kind of talking about this a lot and making it a political issue or inflaming it.
Well, pretty quickly, you saw the social media posts, and as you said, most of them were conservative initially, and then now we're seeing pushback on the other side and folks on the left drawing some conclusions as well. And so this does cut both ways when we talk about people making snap judgments about something they're seeing on the internet. So I want to be clear about that, but, you know, this is all kind of predictable, I think, based on what we've seen in the last few years in our political culture. We saw this with, the Haitian rumors back in the last fall in the presidential campaign. It's a combination of actual videos and things you see, and then people drawing conclusions from those things and assigning a narrative to something that may or may not be true. People do this just to stir things up, and people do this for political purposes. You name it, it's out there on social media. And so I think, we have seen this push beyond just social media. It's been the Vice President of the United States addressed it a few days later when he was in Ohio on a scheduled visit. It is now, this is part of this broader political, cultural debate about these issues that seem to be confounding this country every day.
Becca, you attended a meeting with downtown residents and city officials earlier this week. Here's Police Chief Teresa Thiege.
Let me be clear, crystal clear. That was a violent, violent encounter. It makes me sick to watch it over and over again on national news, especially. I do not like Cincinnati being portrayed in a negative light on the national news. We can do better. We can do so much better. That being said, I will not tolerate lawlessness on the streets of Cincinnati. I owe it to you, as people who live and work here, to get the lawlessness under control. Okay? Now, I also want to emphasize, there is no room for politics in law enforcement. No politics.
Becca, what concerns were people raising at that meeting?
Well, first, I think it's important to say this was not a city-sponsored meeting. It was organized by the Downtown Residents Council and scheduled several weeks before this viral incident happened. So there have been concerns predating this about violence downtown, particularly in and over the Rhine. And so that was a response to that. And so it was sponsored by the Downtown Residents Council. They invited City Manager Cheryl Long, Police Chief Teresa Thiege. They also had 3CDC CEO Steve Leeper as one of the panelists. They did address the video. It was what was on everyone's minds. The room was packed. There were people who couldn't get into the room. I think the fight had a lot to do with how big the meeting got. But when it came time to resident and, other downtown stakeholder questions, nobody asked about the fight. The questions were around how the city can enforce curfew for young people. Worth noting that there's no evidence to suggest anyone involved in that fight was a minor. We are expecting more information on potential curfew enforcement next week when council is in session for the sort of 1 week break during their summer session. Residents asked about loud motorcycles and cars, like kind of revving their engines and doing drag races on downtown streets. They asked about nuisance businesses like bars or places that sell alcohol, and what the city can do to kind of enforce, you know, challenging the liquor licenses if needed and that kind of thing. They asked about public safety strategy down at the banks, and they asked about collaboration. You know, what can residents and the police and the city manager's office and the city in general do to collaborate better on issues of public safety? I should also note that, you know, there were many questions that there weren't time to address. And so, you know, I'm sure there were other questions involved that we just didn't get a chance to hear. But those were kind of the main concerns that we heard from.
And you talked about how City Manager Cheryl Long was there, 3CDC CEO Steve Leeper. I understand the mayor made a virtual appearance. Why did he attend virtually?
Well, the first answer is the mayor was never purported to be at the meeting. He was not scheduled to be at the meeting. He was on vacation this week. He did choose to give a brief virtual message live during the meeting. I can only assume that that is because of the extra news media attention that has been on crime, including national attention that has been on crime lately. But he was never scheduled to be part of the meeting.
Okay. I want to mention we've gotten some emails to our newsroom. This is an email that came to multiple newsrooms in the region from Vince in East Price Hill. It reads in part, crime in this city is at low rates and getting lower, even where some crimes are up in some areas. It's largely because rates were low and had almost nowhere to go but up. Yet your endless, breathless coverage of one ugly incident that was likely set off by a white provocateur is misrepresenting the Black people who were part of it and those who stayed out of it. Your coverage is making this entire city look like a war zone, inviting the involvement of the state police force and the FBI, and providing excuses for fascists to cut off funding to the city. The email goes on, but I think that shows a little bit about the different perspectives that you referred to, Dan, earlier, about how people on different parts of the political spectrum are reacting to this whole thing. Cameron, you mentioned that 3 arrests have been made in this case. Are more arrests expected?
Yes. So they initially said that they had identified 5 people as suspects. And like I said, 3 of those people have been arrested. It is unclear to me if in incidents in the past, there have been times where there have been people who have been identified as victims who are also kind of suspects. There's no indication that that's the case here, but it has happened in the past. There's also, but yeah, as of right now, I would assume that they're at least looking for another 2 people. But as of this morning, and we've been keeping a pretty close eye on this, as of this morning, there haven't been any additional arrests that we know of.
And Cameron, my understanding is one of the suspects arrested was out on bond on a weapons charge at the time of this fight. Has anybody commented about that?
Correct. So there was one of the suspects had was released on a $4,000 bond on basically carrying concealed weapons and weapons under disability. He had a prior felony conviction from several years ago, and I was again caught, or police say he was found with another weapon, which means that he was possessing it illegally. And he had been out for quite a while on that charge awaiting trial. And that has been sort of an ongoing, another kind of political battle that's been back and forth, especially in Cincinnati, has been this talk of bonds being too low, dangerous people being let out on the street by certain judges, while the other side says, you know, these bonds can be kind of punitive in nature, they can really wreck people's lives and all of that. So that's sort of been an ongoing pushback between the Cincinnati FOP and some pro-law enforcement folks pushing for higher bonds, more detention, and that kind of thing.
Becca, you've been reporting on crime data. That email I read a few minutes ago referenced crime data and what the data shows for the city. You talked to Corey Haberman at UC.
You can have what sometimes we refer to as these signal crimes, right? You have a crime, maybe it's very heinous, maybe it's in a public location, maybe you know, something happened that it involves particular people, maybe somebody's famous or something like that, right? And it becomes a story, a news story, if you will. That can, you know, sometimes signal to people that there is an issue. And then you go and say, maybe look at larger kind of those aggregate crime trends. And it actually maybe we don't necessarily have more crime. Now, that's not to say that that particular incident isn't extremely alarming, that it's not important to us, that we don't want to think about preventing it in the future, right? Or even, you know, helping the victims of that particular incident, right? We don't want to downplay any given incident. But at the same time, it may not mean that there's a larger overall problem, right? We don't know that until we look at the data.
The data is certainly important. There have also been a number of public safety meetings, and the mayor and chief have said crime is their top priority. Tell us a little bit about the data and how the public perception of safety factors into all this.
Yeah, I think public perception is one of the biggest factors here. It's something that city officials, including the mayor and the police chief, have both addressed directly. You know, the data changes frequently. That's something to keep in mind. There's always a spike in crime in the summer. The spike this summer has been more significant than in recent years, and that is important to note. It is important, though, that Cincinnati is a big city. I mean, it's a small city, but we know what we mean when we say that. Looking at the Central Business District and Riverfront neighborhood, for over the last 28 days, robbery is up about 50% compared to last year. That's year-to-date data. Aggravated assault up about 43%, again, compared to last year. But when we say something like violent crime is up or violent crime is down, that's not necessarily a useful piece of information, right? You know, because looking, when we say violent crime, that also includes homicides and rapes. Both of those are down in the Central Business District compared to last year. So the data is certainly important. It's something that city officials have been trying to report out more frequently. They've been having these press conferences every 2 weeks. You know, when asked about this idea of public perception, the police chief and the mayor have both said that perception matters, even if there are times when the data, you know, does not support sort of the fears that people are experiencing. But they say that the perception matters as well, and that they are working not necessarily to change people's minds, but to do whatever they can to change that perception so that people feel safe living, working, or visiting downtown.
Becca, I know Ohio gubernatorial candidate Vivek Ramaswamy has a town hall scheduled to address crime concerns here in Cincinnati. When and where will that be happening?
Yeah, that's on Monday evening. It starts at 5:30 at Jim and Jack's. That's in Riverside on the west side. Again, at 5:30, I believe our reporter Nick Swartzel will be covering that.
Okay. And I know you said council's back in session next week and curfew may be on the agenda, right?
That's right. Okay. To be determined.
Well, I've been talking with Cincinnati Inquirer investigative reporter Dan Horn and breaking news reporter Cameron Knight and WVXU local government reporter Becca Costello. Thank you all so much for your time today.
Thanks, Lucy.
Thanks, Lucy.
Thanks so much.
Up next, Kentucky's Fancy Farm Picnic is this weekend. We'll discuss which politicians could get roasted. This is Cincinnati Edition. Politics and barbecue are back on the menu at Kentucky's Fancy Farm Picnic. Which politicians could end up getting roasted? You're listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Joining me now is Kentucky Lantern state politics reporter McKenna Horsley. Welcome back, McKenna.
Thanks for having me.
We appreciate your being here. Fancy Farm is this weekend. I know you're going to be heading that way later today. Explain what it is for people who don't know.
Yes. So the Fancy Farm Picnic in far west Kentucky is one of Kentucky politics' premier traditions. This will be the 145th Fancy Farm Picnic this weekend. And it's kind of a political rally meets local country fair. It is a fundraiser for the St. Jerome Catholic Church in the town of Fancy Farm, Kentucky. But while there are things like games, a bingo hall, as well as barbecue for sale throughout the day, the thing that brings a lot of politicians and media outlets to the event is the political speaking that is slated for Saturday afternoon. And while this political speaking is not just the traditional politicians speaking to a silent crowd or a crowd that's listening. The crowd is full of Democrats and Republicans, both cheering and booing their favorite and least favorite politicians that are appearing on the stage. And also, throughout the decades, it's kind of become a way for politicians to, as you kind of said, roast each other while their opponent is feet away, also watching the spectacle themselves. So it's definitely a very high energy event, and it brings an annual tradition to the Kentucky political circuit every year.
Who are going to be the big speakers this year?
So Kentucky doesn't have any statewide elections this year, but we are definitely seeing some gearing up for the 2026 races. The big things that I will be watching for will be the Republican U.S. Senate candidates. So that's Andy Barr, a current congressman, former Attorney General Daniel Cameron, and Lexington businessman Nate Morris. And Barr and Cameron, I think Barr, but definitely Cameron has been at Fancy Farm in recent years as AG, and last year he was there as a surrogate for the Trump campaign during 24 elections. So it will be interesting to see how these people approach these each other and kind of differentiating themselves in front of Republicans as well, but while also sharing a stage. Also, we do not know yet if Senator Mitch McConnell will attend this year. Usually his attendance is confirmed right before the speaking begins or something like that, or on Saturday. But if he does go, it will definitely be interesting to see, because the three Republican candidates have tried to distance themselves from his legacy as he leaves office as a way to kind of bring themselves closer to Trump and hopefully get an endorsement from the president in this race.
Now, those three Republican candidates you mentioned, they'll all be running in a primary against each other, trying to get that Senate seat that Senator Mitch McConnell has held for so long. Is it unusual to have primary candidates at Fancy Farm? I thought it was usually people who'd already been through their primaries and it was a Democrat taking on a Republican or vice versa.
It is definitely unusual, but it has happened before in the past, I believe. But this is kind of the one time it's happened in most recent history. We have seen Senate races, particularly as they're heading into the general election in the fall, headline Fancy Farm before. There's been a few races between Mitch McConnell and different challengers against him, such as former Governor Steve Beshear, has made a headline at Fancy Farm. We've seen Rand Paul and Charles Booker, the former Democratic candidate that year, definitely get some media attention. So it is interesting to watch. But also, I kind of think that that's a reflection of where the Republican Party is here in Kentucky. We've seen kind of in recent cycles, particularly as Republicans have had long-standing control of the state house and state offices, turn their focus more to primaries and getting into those races as well early on, and kind of less focus on the general election in Kentucky.
Now, you mentioned Senator McConnell isn't confirmed as a speaker yet. Is it possible that he could be a target of some of the other Republican speakers? I mean, President Trump and Senator McConnell don't always see eye to eye, and certainly the state of Kentucky went big for President Trump.
Yeah, it's definitely possible that McConnell will be the target of some jokes at Fancy Farm, but also he's been going for 40 years at this point, so he's definitely been, you know, the target of some jokes in the past, so I don't think that will be unusual for him. But it will be interesting to see that come from the Republican side, particularly in this election cycle, and with how this primary is shaping up. One of the candidates, Nate Morris, has been pretty vocally against Mitch McConnell, and he's kind of using that to target a lane out against his candidates in this primary, his opposing candidates in this primary. Recently, one of the things that he's done is he's called on the Republican Party of Kentucky to rescind a Lifetime Achievement Award for the outgoing senator. because he believes he's very unpopular in the state. And that dinner is supposed to take place next weekend. So if they are all on stage together, it could definitely shape up to be an interesting spectacle to see.
Yeah. Well, Representative Thomas Massie is the focus of political attack ads precipitated by the president.
What happened to Thomas Massie? President Trump is banning sex changes on minors. Massie voted against it.
Do you think there's any chance he'll be a target at Fancy Farm, McKenna?
He may. You know, that's definitely an interesting primary as well here in Kentucky. But because the location of the event, it's in the it's in a different congressional district. So Massie was not invited to be a speaker at the event. But yeah, I think that's definitely a race that Republicans are watching in Kentucky for sure.
Yeah. McKinney, will any high profile Democrats be there, the governor or the lieutenant governor?
That's a great question. So leading up to this year, Governor Andy Beshear has said that he will not be attending this year due to a conflicting event. And also Lieutenant Governor Jacqueline Coleman will not be attending. When I reached out to her spokesperson, she said via the spokesperson that she believes the picnic should be reserved for candidates who are currently on the ballot so they can share their vision for the Commonwealth at this event. And neither of them are on the ballot for this year. One Democrat who was invited, Senate candidate Pamela Stevenson, who is in the House of Representatives here in Kentucky, she declined to attend this year. And she was invited to speak alongside these primary candidates in the Senate race. And it's unclear why she declined to do it this year. But I think if she continues on in the race, she'll be there next year for sure.
Hmm. Are any high-profile Republicans skipping the event this year?
We do have some Republicans that are that were invited but will not be there. But kind of like Jacqueline Coleman said, these Republicans are not on the ballot, so it might not be as important for them to be there. But that includes U.S. Senator Rand Paul, Auditor Alan Ball, and Secretary of State Michael Adams. And I believe Michael Adams told Fancy Farm organizers that he will have a conference this year, so that's why he's not there.
Hmm. Is Fancy Farm still important? We started out with your describing it as this kind of premier political event in Kentucky politics. It has been for decades at this point. I guess, what's the argument that it's still relevant? And is there anyone arguing that it's not anymore?
Yes, and I definitely think that is a conversation that's being had this year because of Beshear not attending this year. He didn't attend last year either amid the 2024 elections, but he was still talked about on stage from Republican speakers because he was at that time in the running to be a vice presidential candidate pick for Kamala Harris and her campaign at that point. But some Republicans definitely still see value in going to this event. There's only one Democrat that will be speaking. That's Drew Williams, who is challenging Congressman James Comer. But so most of the speakers for tomorrow will be Republicans. And Republicans say that I spoke to about this event, say that they still believe that it has relevance to politics today as it's a chance to interact with voters on the ground in a region that's far from our capital, Frankfurt, and kind of speak with voters one-on-one. It's also a chance to get involved with party activists and elected officials, in events leading up to Fancy Farm, such as dinners and luncheons and things of that nature. However, the Democrats kind of see this as an event that's become largely Republican, kind of going back to that speaking lineup. Morgan Eves, the executive director of the Kentucky Democratic Party, told me that Democratic candidates should be everywhere a voter is, particularly in election years. But they should not put themselves in a position where they will be unfairly targeted either by individuals on stage or by the audience. And she predicted this year, because of the Senate candidates being there, that this will be a Republican bloodbath in front of the audience this year.
Hmm. So what are you going to be watching for most at Fancy Farm?
Definitely the Senate candidates. And I will also be watching if Mitch McConnell goes to see if he has any chuckles at some of the things that he might say or that he might hear on stage. Like I've said, you know, McConnell's rise to power definitely includes Fancy Farm. Early on in the 1980s, when he was running for Senate the first time, he was very much outnumbered by Democrats. Kentucky was largely a Democratic state at the time. But he would bus Republicans to Fancy Farm to kind of drum up the crowd. And so I think that's also kind of why Republicans are still very fond of the event, because it's not been so far removed from what it was once like. So I think that for sure that will be something I'm watching.
Well, I have been talking with Kentucky Lantern state politics reporter McKenna Horsley. Thanks for your time today, McKenna. Drive safe.
Thanks for having me.
Up next, do they or don't they? We'll ask whether Hamilton County and the Bengals have a deal. This is Cincinnati Edition. Hamilton County commissioners voted Thursday to approve a new Paycor Stadium lease deal with the Bengals. Does that mean the deal is done? You're tuned to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Joining me now to break it down for us is WCPO9 I-Team reporter Dan Monk. Welcome back, Dan.
Hi, Lucy. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. 2 weeks in a row to talk about the Bengals. Let's see if we're going to make it a third. So two county commissioners voted yesterday to approve this lease deal with the Bengals, but it's not over. Why not?
Well, the Bengals don't agree to it. The county signed or agreed to a lease that they're comfortable with, and they sent it to the Bengals. And the Bengals said they need time to review it. They hadn't seen this version of the lease before, and so they have not confirmed that they want to sign it. And we'll find out today at 4 o'clock. County commissioners are holding a meeting. Today is the deadline for the Bengals to exercise a two-year option to extend the original lease. And so their choices today are conveyed to the county that they're going to sign this document that the county sent them yesterday, or they could say, we've signed the lease option and we're going to extend the lease for another 2 years.
Always comes down to the deadline, doesn't it? Remember back in the day when former commissioner, our city council member Todd Portune changed the clock in city council chambers? Because it's always a deadline thing.
That's true. You raise a third alternative. They could turn the clock or the calendar.
Yeah. Sure. Just change the clock. That always works. Did county commissioners know before the vote that the lease wasn't a done deal?
Yes, they did know that. By the time they walked into the door, they had an executive session in the morning, and the Bengals had sent the county a version of the lease the night before, and the county couldn't accept that. They ended up sending back to the team a version that they could accept. And I think they were hoping the Bengals would just say, okay, we'll sign it. And that's not what happened. So now today we've got the drama.
Yeah. Remind us again about the scope of this renovation. What's the price tag the county and the team have sort of agreed to? Who's paying what?
Yeah, this is a $470 million renovation. The county's agreed to pay $350 million. The team and the NFL are paying $120 million. And then there are all kinds of operating terms related to rent and operating expenses. But it's an 11-year lease that can be extended in two-year increments over 10 years. So it's going to run at least until 2036 if it gets signed, and then possibly 10 years beyond that.
You mentioned that the Bengals sent over a deal that the county couldn't agree to. The county Senate agreed to a deal that they sent to the Bengals. What does County Administrator Jeff Aluto say the sticking point is with this whole thing?
He says the big sticking point is parking. And specifically, it's parking that could be taken away if portions of the banks are redeveloped or areas of the riverfront are taken. For example, the Brent Spence Bridge is taking some land down there, the Brent Spence Bridge project. And the Bengals have plans to expand their practice facility or replace it with a better one. And so there could be some development that the Bengals do on that site. There are blocks that are unfinished at the banks where the Bengals fans now park. And we know that the Bengals are very keen on tailgating spaces. It's a big part of the NFL experience, and they want to preserve that outdoor feeling. So the 8,000 car parking garage that's available to Bengals fans, you know, not as great an option as an outdoor vibe where you can toss a football and set up your tent and have a grill actively going. You know, it's better to be outside if you're tailgating, and the Bengals love to preserve that space. And basically what Aluto said was it came down to the Bengals wanting some assurance that either the county would replace lost spaces when parcels are developed, or replace the revenue they would have gotten from those spaces, you know, if they lose them. And so what the county ended up doing was putting language into the lease that would guarantee that they'd replace up to 350 spaces, or give the Bengals, I think it's $175,000 per season as compensation for losing parking spaces. And apparently that wasn't enough for the Bengals.
Huh. You talked with Northern Kentucky University President Joe Cobbs about all of this. What did he say about the negotiations kind of coming down to the wire like this?
Well, one thing he said is that it's risky for both sides, really, to push this into the season. I mean, you know, last year, the Bengals and the county appeared to be making progress, and then this is the time of the year when everything stopped. You know, August 7th is the first preseason game. The Bengals don't want to be negotiating while they're in the middle of a season. And so it really behooves both sides to get a deal done quickly. Then Cobbs added that if the Bengals start out slow, like they've done in the last couple of seasons, that will hurt their momentum at the negotiating table. And on the flip side, if they start out winning, everybody's going to be excited about the team, and that's going to hurt the county's negotiating position. So he said there's a big advantage for both sides to settle now because it resolves everything. They don't have to worry about it during the season. And, you know, we'll see if that's comes into play this afternoon when they reveal what happened.
Yeah, that's a lot of pressure to have on Joe Burrow's shoulders if they don't have a deal before the season starts. I know Commissioner Alicia Reese said that there are some other implications with this lease deal, too. What is she concerned about?
She's concerned about property tax rebates. She said that she was told that they'll never be able to do a 30% rebate under the structure of this lease.
Never.
Takes away the county's. Yeah, that's what she said. Mm-hmm. And that's one reason why she proposed putting this deal before voters. She didn't get a second on her motion to put that before the commission, so commissioners never voted on it. And but, you know, Commissioner Driehaus said that, Denise Driehaus said that property tax rebates can still happen under this structure, and it really will depend on how much comes in sales tax collections. And as you recall, the original projections for sales tax revenue really never panned out the way they thought they would when they were building the stadium in the late 90s. And Denise Driehaus says that's the biggest reason why property tax rebates haven't been fully funded at 30% the way they were expected to be done when voters approved the idea of a sales tax to finance new stadium construction.
You just mentioned how Commissioner Alicia Reese had a motion to, hey, let's let the voters decide on this lease agreement, essentially put it on the ballot. Any idea how the logistics of that would work? These lease deals are pretty long, right? I mean, I imagine it's a lot of pages.
Yeah. I think the more likely scenario, and Chris Wetterich at the Business Courier has done some good reporting on this, the more likely scenario is that they sign a deal, commissioners authorize it, and then if people want a vote on this, there would have to be a referendum to place it on the ballot. But at this point, it takes two votes by commissioners to request a prosecutor's opinion on whether it's legal to place a lease on the ballot. There is even some question about whether it is legal. And so it kind of looks like this proposal to put it on the ballot is stuck at the county commission level for one thing, Alicia Reese doesn't have a second vote to do it. And secondly, there are questions about whether it's even legal to put a lease on the ballot.
Okay. Well, you referenced earlier that the county has called this emergency meeting for 4 o'clock today. We're talking now several hours before that meeting. Any predictions about whether they'll be announcing a final deal for real? Or what do you think the different alternatives are for what happens there?
I months ago when this whole thing started gearing up, my prediction was that the Bengals would exercise their two-year option. And ultimately, I think that's probably what's going to happen.
Really?
I've been wrong before, though.
Dan, say it isn't so. You have. So that'd be a pretty quick meeting, wouldn't it? If they just get together to say, hey, the Bengals are going to, I mean, and what are the implications of that for the county if the Bengals do exercise that option to, is it a 2-year extension?
It would be a 2-year extension, but you know, there's language in the lease document that they released yesterday that says, when the new lease is signed and the NFL approves it and it's, you know, everything's final, then the old lease goes away. So, given that, you know, it's possible that they could, announce today that they're extending the lease for 2 more years, and they could say, we've made progress on a lot of fronts and we're going to keep talking. And, you know, maybe before the season starts, they'll have a new deal. And ultimately that deal will replace the old lease. So I don't think it's closing the book on a settlement. The Bengals have brokered, you know, a lot of compromise with the county on a lot of issues. And so if it's just one issue of parking, I would think they'd be able to resolve it. Question is whether they have time to do that before the season starts.
Yeah. Yeah. So they could get a 2-year extension and try to get her done in 6 days, is what you're saying?
It could happen.
Okay. Well, you've heard it here first, ladies and germs. Dan Monk, it could happen. This is his prediction. That'd be a really short 4 o'clock meeting. So we'll see how that goes. I've been talking with WCPO9 iTeam reporter Dan Monk. Thanks for your time today, Dan. I hope you have a great weekend.
You too.
Thank you. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Harper Carlton. Technical director is Carlos Lopez Cornu. And if you miss our program live, you can find Cincinnati Edition wherever you get your podcasts. You can even subscribe. Push that little button. Just go ahead and subscribe. I'm Lucy May. Thank you so much for listening.